One of our most important purposes in the seminary is to teach people to exegete, to take the words of the scripture and to understand exactly what they say. And therefore, I was quite disappointed in one portion of the tests that were turned in to find a very glaring failure on exegesis of a question on the part of some who usually do very well in tests. And that brought the mark way down to what they would have been otherwise. I asked the question to discuss the earliest questions about Mosaic authorship. And I had a section in the outline about the early questions of Mosaic authorship in which we discussed these questions way back in the 17th century when they discussed Deuteronomy 1:1 and other verses in the Pentateuch, which at that time were questioned as to whether they actually were written by Moses. And I discussed each of these verses and showed how I believe they could all have been written by Moses, but also pointed out that even if in the case of one or even of several of these, it were to be proven that they were later insertions, that would not disprove Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. Then later, when we took up Astruc, I tried to make it very clear that Astruc did not question Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. Astruc was 100 years after these objections had been raised and had been satisfactorily answered. But Astruc did not question Mosaic authorship at all. But Astruc raised the question of dividing it into documents, which he said Moses had used in writing the book of Genesis. So they're entirely different areas. It is true that the theories of partition, of dividing it into sources, like Astruc advanced, when carried on by Eichhorn, led to a denial of Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. But they were not denials of Mosaic authorship, and they certainly were not early denials, because the earliest were a full century earlier. And so when some students who usually do very well in tests gave a fine discussion of Astruc and Eichhorn under the question of the earliest objections to Mosaic authorship, I couldn't give any credit, naturally, for such a complete misunderstanding of the question. Now, if this was a final examination and someone who ordinarily got high marks so completely misinterpreted the question, I'm sure I would make considerable allowance for it. I would think that he was up late the night before or something like that that caused him not to read the question carefully. But since this is only one of three tests, and it'll all be averaged in, if it brings the mark down a little bit, I think that it's not too much to be a little warning to be a little more careful in exegesis. It can, if it was an interpretation of a vital passage of the Bible, it would really be serious. The next test will be a week from tomorrow. As you know, we have no meeting tomorrow. But the next test is a week from tomorrow. And that will cover everything up to that point. Important as the material is since the last test, this material is not very meaningful if you do not have an idea of the basis which we dealt with prior to the last test. And so be particularly sure, please, in connection with this test, that you're ready on all the work of the semester thus far, not merely on that since the last test. Also, I want to give you an assignment, a fairly large assignment, which is not due until 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks from today, I would like you to have a paper. It is not as big a paper as the three we had in the introduction, as any one of those, but a sizable paper. I would like you to take this paper that I gave you yesterday on Driver's analysis of Genesis, and read the passages that he assigns to the P document in Genesis. Then I would like you to give me a discussion of the completeness of the P document. That is, the completeness of it as a document, thinking of it as having circulated, according to the critical theory, independently, apart from the J or the E document. Does it look like something that would be a complete document in that way? Now, just as one illustration, compare how much it gives about the creation and the flood with how much it gives about the lives of Jacob's faith and see how it compares and whether it is really seems to be a complete document. Also note whether it assumes certain facts which leave it ununderstandable without the other documents. As for instance, it tells about the creation of the world and how God made a very good world, and then it tells about, gives the genealogy, and then it says, and the world was filled with violence. Now, after God made such a good world, how does it get filled with violence? It gives you no explanation. But, of course, in the Bible, the explanation is perfectly clear, because Genesis 3 tells of the fall. But that's part of the J document, according to them. So you see, for this particular assignment, you will not need to bother with what's in the J or E document, except that they are omitted from the P document. And the question is, how complete is the story of P? How complete an account does it give of the matters with which it deals? And also, is there much that it takes for granted that needs to be explained in order to understand it, and that is explained in the other documents? Now that is the assignment then, which is due 2 weeks from today. I think that's ample time, so I'd like to have all the papers in by that time. If you don't leave it for the last two or three days, if you get laid up with sickness the previous two or three days, why, you could do it much earlier. So please do it and have it on time. Yes? Well, let's say this. Consider it about a fifth of a whole semester outside of time. About a fifth. That is to say, if we would ordinarily do 2 hours of work outside for one class, and if the semester has, say, 28 classes, say a fifth of that would be about, I would say 12 to 15 hours would be answered. 12 to 15 hours would be answered. Not a big paper like was an introduction. Yes? No, because some people express a lot in a few sentences, and some people can fill up with words without much idea. So I don't think pages tell much. But I'd rather you wouldn't make it too concise so that it's difficult to understand what you mean. Use extra words if necessary. But I mean, it's an idea, not a word. Yes?
I have a question. Have academics ever tried to work in the theory that, for example,
the
doctrine, the doctrine,
and the certain sections on it? Yes. Very. Yes. Yeah. Now, Mr. Seck has called attention to a very important feature of the matter, and it's well worth our taking a few minutes on. The critical theory is, as it has been held by all the critics for the last 70 years. Now, there are variations, but this is fundamental to what they've all held, that these were separate, independent documents, and that we can tell the difference between them as we compare them and note the fact that each is a complete document and yet that they contradict each other on secondary points at many places and that they have a very different style according to them. Well now, the question, according to their view, these were complete independent documents. But you ask the question, do we have the complete document today? And for answer to that, you have to see what sort of arguments they use in their discussion. And in their discussion, they make frequent statements like this. The P document knows nothing of any sacrifice prior to the command given to Moses. The P document knows nothing about this, that, or the other thing. That is to say, many of their arguments assume that we have the documents completely. However, it is true, on the other hand, that when you point out deficiencies, when you point out something that is simply assumed and not given, then they will say, oh, that document must originally have had an account of that in it, which was omitted because the redactor liked better the account in the other document. So that it is never stated by the critics that we have absolutely everything that is in them, but the whole tenor of their statement is to the effect that we have most of it. And they make much of something being not held by a certain document because it is not in what we have, which certainly is an assumption that we have practically all. This is a very important question. I don't know whether I would have discussed it at this point if the question hadn't been raised here, but if it's so important, it would be worth our touching on two or three times, because it is very important in connection with all aspects of this question. So I'm glad you asked it. Yes, now, we were speaking yesterday then about the parallel story, and we discussed the story of the sending of the spies. And we notice how in the sending of the spies, they say there is a contradiction. Because one story says that they went to Hebron, and they got many very fine things at Hebron. And the other story says that they went, they spied out the land clear up to the entering of Hamath. A contradiction. One says they went this far, the other says they went the whole distance. And, of course, when they say that, they assume there that we have the complete of both documents. Because neither one says they stopped at Hebron. It says they went to Hebron. And if you were to describe a trip that you made to Europe, you might say, I made a trip to Europe one summer, and I visited England, France, Germany, Greece, and Turkey. Then you would say, on such and such a day, I left Philadelphia in a boat, and I arrived in England, and I spent so long a time visiting different things in England. Now, to take that out and say that's a separate document, and then you have one statement, you went as far as Turkey, and the other statement simply tells about your visit to England, makes a contradiction, but it is a contradiction of assuming that you have the whole thing. And a great many of their alleged contradictions are exactly this type. Well, we looked into the story of the account of the sending of the spies, and we noticed how a number of the alleged contradictions are this way. Like they say, one says that Caleb and Joshua resisted the other spies and said that they could conquer the land. The other one says Caleb killed the people. So they say, according to one document, it was only Caleb that differed with the others. According to the other document, it was Caleb and Joshua. There's no contradiction there. You speak of something that three men did, or you may speak of the part that one had in it and not mention the other. And since these events spread over two or three days anyway, it is altogether possible that on one particular day, Joshua was sick and was in his tent and not there, or that Moses had sent him to perform a service that day. And so that in the discussion of that day, Caleb was the only one present. It's not necessary to explain every detail like that. But the fact that in one case they say Caleb and Joshua disagreed with the others, and in the other case they say Caleb stilled the people, does not imply that there are two different contradictory stories. But a very great number of the alleged contradictions are of exactly that kind. They are arguments from silence. The argument from silence is one which enters in at many points in the discussion of the higher criticism. And I think it is important that we have a clear understanding of the situation regarding the argument from silence. The argument from silence may be a good argument. It may be a strong argument. If something is omitted that we would expect to be contained there. But the argument from silence is not an argument of any validity simply because something is not mentioned. I think that's very important. Sometimes people say, oh, that's just the argument from silence. Well, the argument from silence can be very important. If you find a document telling about a person's life in England during the years between 1935 and 1950, and they tell you year by year about the events that occurred in their lives, and they never mention World War II or the Blitz or the bombings in England during that period, you can very well question, is this document really about 1930 to 1950? Is it perhaps really about 1830 to 1850? Or is it perhaps something somebody made up who didn't know anything about the history of this period? That is something which anybody living in England during that time would have been so prominently connected with, he'd been so greatly affected by it, that it is pretty difficult to think of it not being mentioned in anything that purported to be at all a full account of a man's experiences during those years. Marco Polo tells us how much he was impressed by the paper money in China. He saw people in Europe carrying around great big loads of metal. In order to anything you bought, you had to carry metal. And in China, they had paper money. And that impressed him so wonderful that he laid great stress on it in his account of his trip to China. But he never mentioned printing. Though printing was unknown in Europe at the time, and the paper money that impressed Marco Polo so much was actually printed. The printing was there. But Marco Polo wasn't impressed by it enough to notice it, enough to mention it, at least, in his account. Now, somebody could easily make an argument from silence. Marco Polo certainly isn't dependable because he doesn't mention printing. He wasn't printing in China that time because he never mentioned it. The paper money he mentions was printed, but it didn't occur to him to mention. Someone over here had a question, Mr. Yes? Yeah. If it would be very, very strange if the matter were not mentioned, then, well, it depends on how strong the expectation is that it will be mentioned. The argument from silence tends to be a weak argument, but it's an argument the critics constantly use. It tends to be a weak argument. But it is not an argument that under certain circumstances may not have great weight. So I just think we should be a bit cautious in saying, oh, that's just an argument from silence. A good argument from silence can be a very good argument. But in a great many cases, it is an argument with no validity at all. Well, we mentioned various features about the interlaced story, according to critics, of the sending of the spy. Another similar instance is the story of the rebellion against Moses of Dathan and Abiram. This is a story in Numbers that goes through several chapters, and they tear it out into two sections and make two parallel stories out of it. And I have a long discussion of that in my commentary on Numbers, my little commentary on Numbers. I won't take time to go into it now, except to mention that you have two or three different elements there which are involved in the rebellion against Moses. And it is not, the probabilities are, no one of these elements would have had the courage to have raised up against Moses if it were not for the other element rising up at the same time. But the different elements had different purposes in mind. They united for a common cause against Moses. And we're told about them, and we're told about each element of it, and God dealt differently with each element of it, but he defeated them all. And you can separate them out and have the stories of two different conspiracies with different people in them and different results. And of course, there were two different conspiracies with different results. But the chances are neither of them would have occurred if they hadn't gotten courage to do it from the fact that the other people were disgruntled at the same time for a different reason. And they were so different that God dealt with them in different ways. And so your account tells a little about these and a little about these and a little about God's attitude toward these and a little about God's attitude toward these and how God dealt with these and how God dealt with these. And so it's interlaced that way, and they say it must be two stories. There are lots of parallels. Similar but different. But is that true in life constantly? That events which occur in life have different aspects. And if you're going to give a full account, you deal with the different aspects, but that doesn't mean that it's different documents. Now the interlaced document, which is most perhaps presented by the critics, is the story of the flood. And this is natural because this is the earliest interlaced duplicate in the Bible. That is the earliest thing that they claim to be an interlaced in the Bible, is the story of the flood. Their great strength of their argument rests on the fact that they have Genesis 1 in one document, and then 2, 3, and 4 in another. They have fairly large sections that they assign to different documents. But now they come to the flood story, and they give a half a verse to this, and 2 verses to that, and 5 verses to this, and 3 quarters of a verse to that, and so on. And they pull these out, and they thus get your 2 different stories, which are thus interlaced. And they claim that we therefore have clear evidence of 2 different documents giving the story of the flood. Well, we've already mentioned the fact that the flood story has a great many repetitions of ideas. It is not a matter of having things told twice. It's a matter of having many things told 4, 5, or maybe 7 times. And the reason for that is that, as in any story that is vividly told, you have a particular aspect stressed and emphasized. And you have the wickedness of man mentioned and stressed and emphasized. And you have 4 or 5 statements which are different aspects, perhaps, but any one of them would give the general idea. But he wants to emphasize the great wickedness of man. Then you have God telling Noah that he's going to send the flood, and you have the flood coming, and when the flood comes, you have a great emphasis on how the waters come, and they rise, and they spread out, and they go over the earth, and they go to and fro. You have great emphasis on that with many phrases which are somewhat similar in order to stress the tremendous nature of that great flood. And then you have phrases stressing the continuation of it, how the waters continued, went continually back and forth, and they spread over the whole earth, and the tops of the high mountains were covered, and so on. You have these things repeatedly stressed in order to drive home to you very vividly the tremendous impression that it makes. And then you have stressed the long period of waiting while the waters go down. They go down a little bit. And then they begin to see the tops of the mountains, and then he sends a bird out, and the bird plucks off a leaf and brings it back, and he sends out another bird, and the bird flies round and round and doesn't come back, and you send another bird, and this one doesn't find any place to roost, and it comes back, and you have the stress on the long period of the gradual subsidence of the water, and then they see the dry land, and they come out, and they make a sacrifice, and God makes them a promise. So you have many things in the flood story that are repeated for vividness, with perhaps a slight difference in the emphasis repeated frequently. You could, in many points, make 5 or 6 different parallel stories. But then you have many events in connection with the flood which are only told once. And you cannot find any parallel in the other place. It's interesting that we have 3 birds sent out, and they put them all 3 in the J document. They do not put one of them in P, one in J, and one in E. They put all 3 in the J document. So that there you have no parallel. You have nothing in the P document corresponding to that. You have a sacrifice at the end. You have the coming out of the ark. It's only in one document. You have a sacrifice performed. It's only in one document. You have the covenant with Noah. It's only in one document. So that the many repetitions in the flood story are not simply 2 repetitions, but many of aspects that need emphasis, and there are many elements in the account of the flood which are only given once. And therefore, if you divide it into 2 documents, you have many things in one that are not in the other. One gives the dimensions of the ark, one or the other doesn't. One tells about going into the ark, the other simply says God shut them in. One tells about the sacrifice afterwards, the other doesn't mention it. The other one tells about the covenant, this one doesn't mention it. And of course one tells about the birds, and the other doesn't mention it. You have many things for which there is not thus a parallel. Now, there's a very interesting thing in connection with this story of the flood. Back about 100 years ago, there was a man named George Smith, who was working in the British Museum. And George Smith, going through some tablets that had been brought from Mesopotamia in the cuneiform writing in the ancient Babylonian language, found in these tablets a few lines which sounded like the story of the flood. And so George Smith told in a meeting in London, he gave an account of the discovery of an ancient account of Noah's flood. And it aroused great interest throughout England, and a newspaper there gave a considerable sum of money to allow George Smith to go to Mesopotamia to hunt for more material about the flood. And so he went to Mesopotamia, and he was a brilliant young man, and he worked very energetically, gathered a great many very important tablets, did some very fine work in the study of ancient Babylonian material, and wore himself out with it all and died as a very young man. But he made a great contribution to the progress of the studies of the ancient Mesopotamian civilization during his short life. But this which he found was part of a long Babylonian epic, which we call the Epic of Gilgamesh. G-I-L-G-A-M-E-S-H. The Epic of Gilgamesh. And this Epic of Gilgamesh, which we are full of copy of it, comes from about the 8th century B.C., but we have a good many sections of it, almost identical with those from the 8th century B.C., from perhaps the 17th or 18th century B.C., from the old Babylonian time. And this Epic of Gilgamesh is a long story about a Babylonian hero and his various experiences, and critics claim to find many points of parallel with the Bible, most of which are highly questionable. Yes? Smith found a little in the British Museum. He found some more when he went to Mesopotamia. Since that time, additional tablets from the sections from the Gilgamesh story have been found. That is, some parts that we have several copies. And it's been found in two or three different types of writing, but essentially the same story. The Babylonian material has constantly been added to during this last century. And but the story, already in Smith's time, most of this particular part of the Gilgamesh, this part about the flood, was available. And this story tells how Gilgamesh's good friend died, and Gilgamesh was anxious to bring him back to life, and so he hunted for someone that could tell him the secret of immortality. And he was told that there was a man who had immortal life, a man who would never die, who was living at a certain distant place, and he went to see this man and find out. And this man told him how he had been informed of the coming of a flood, and how he had gathered his family and a few friends and gone into a boat, and the terrible flood had come, and everybody else had been killed, but they escaped through the flood. And at the end of the flood, the god, the Babylonian god, who had, in a fit of pique against mankind, had decided to destroy them all, was greatly disgusted to find that another god had given away his plan to this man, and thus enabled him to build a boat and escape. But the man, having thus escaped, there's nothing he could do about it, so he made him immortal, so that he would live there in that isolated place and never die. So that's, in very brief, the story, the Babylonian story of the flood. Once in my class in Old Testament history in Wilmington, I read the whole story to the class. And it was most interesting as I read the English translation of the Babylonian story that day, as I read of how the clouds were coming and the flood was approaching, it began to get dark outside. And as I told how the beginning of the flood, the rain began to pour down, and we had a tremendous storm as I read the story, and when I came to the end of it, where they were delivered, the sun came out, and it was very beautiful. And it exactly synchronized with the Babylonian stories I read. But it is a beautiful story, beautifully told in the Babylonian. But it has a great many repetitions in it in order to make things vivid. It is very similar to the biblical story in having these great many repetitions. It is similar to the biblical story in that one man and his family escaped through it. They do not escape by climbing up to the top of a mountain or in some such way as that. They escape, as in the biblical story, by building a boat. And it has a very long, vivid account of the flood coming, describes the destruction of the people more fully than the biblical account does. It, Professor Delitzsch, not Franz, Friedrich Delitzsch, in 1902, in a lecture in Berlin, said how the hero of the Babylonian story felt so bad to see the people perishing in the flood. He says you find no such compassion in the biblical story. He felt the Babylonian story was far superior to the biblical story. I don't think most people feel that way. It has the gods fighting among themselves, one planning to destroy humanity, the others disgusted at him for doing it, one of the others revealing his secret to his favorite, to this man who he does swing safely through it. I think that most readers recognize that though it is a very beautiful story and beautifully told, it is morally and religiously on a much lower level than the biblical story. But the similarities are remarkable in the Babylonian flood story and the biblical story. The secret is revealed that the flood is coming. He builds a boat. They go into the boat before the rain comes. The terrible flood comes. Everybody is killed in it except those in the boat. And then it goes on to tell how after the waters begin to subside, he sends a bird out. And he sends out three birds, just as the biblical story tells of sending out three birds. And then it tells how the flood came to an end, how they came out from the boat, how they made a sacrifice, and then it says the gods had not had any sacrifice all during the flood, so it says the gods gathered like flies around the sacrifice. They were so thrilled to have this sacrifice made to them. And then it tells how the God who had saved this man by warning them and telling them to build the boat, he gives them the promise that humanity will never again be destroyed by a flood, just as we have that in the Bible. So the similarity between that and the biblical story is very, very striking. And personally, I think that is not at all strange. Because, after all, if we do not expect the Babylonian story of creation to be like the biblical story, and it isn't. It's been often said to be similar, but when you compare them, there's no more similarity than you find any two stories of creation. Just say it's a story of creation. And I've seen lists of them. The biblical story tells of the creation of sun, moon, and stars. The Babylonian story tells of the creation of sun, moon, and stars. What kind of creation story do you have if it didn't tell of creation of sun, moon, and stars? The alleged similarities are such as would be in any two stories of creation. I don't think there's any connection whatever between the biblical story of creation and the Babylonian, but this is different. Here you have, we've had floods from time immemorial. There are people who gather a record of a flood somewhere and they say this is another proof of the truth of the flood because they had a flood down in Peru somewhere and the Indians tell about it. Well, everywhere there's a river, there's been floods sometime or other. They've had big ones up here in Pennsylvania various times. The fact of having floods in different places doesn't prove any peril at all. But to have two accounts of a flood that are so similar as these two is very, very striking in many aspects. And the creation occurs so long before the time of the Babylonians, long before the flood, that I would not expect a man who wanted to put the knowledge of God out of their hearts to remember anything about the creation. But the flood would still have been in people's minds at the time of Moses and at the time of this Babylonian story. And the story would have been told and passed on from generation to generation, and it's not at all strange that the Babylonian recollection of the flood, distorted with the passage of time and twisted in many details, would yet have remarkable similarity to the inspired account kept from error of the same flood as contained in the Bible. But now, a very interesting thing about it is that this Babylonian story contains parallels to what we find in the P document and parallels to what we find in the J document. It has It has the God telling him the flood is coming. It has him building a boat. It has dimensions of the boat. It has many things in it which are in one document, many things which are in the other document. It has the sending out of the birds, which is in the J document. It has the measurements of the ark. They're different from the biblical measurements, but it gives measurements, which they put in the P document. It tells about the sacrifice, which they put in the J document. It tells about the promise, which they put in the P document. And thus, you have, according to the critics, the J story of the flood and the P story of the flood, each containing a number of things that aren't in the other. And then we have these interlaced here. And when we get through, we have something which is similar to what we find over in Babylonia from an earlier period. Was it the J document and the P document in Babylonia, which were similar to the J and P in Israel, and which 1,000 years earlier got combined in exactly the same way that they got combined in Israel? It's absolutely inconceivable. And the biblical story then is very parallel, even though differing in many points, yet remarkably parallel to the Babylonian story, and it takes the whole story, not just the J or the P story, to make the full parallel. Mr. Lee, you had a question?
Do any of the critics recognize this problem?
Well, the critics nowadays do not argue much about it. They just know that every sensible person knows that J, that there are different documents. But there was a great deal written 60 years ago arguing on various sides. And I would think it very strange if they didn't say something about this. But I haven't come across it. But it is, to me, a pretty strong argument against their division of the flood story, as it is. The amount that was written 50 to 80 years ago about these things is prodigious. In English, in German, in French, in other languages, it's just a tremendous amount written. But most of these things they don't argue about now because they just know they're true. There isn't so much argument. And then, too, often, I remember once when I was in a Boy Scout camp, we had a little stream we had to jump over, and one of the fellows jumped across in two jumps instead of in one. And he was rather wet when he got out on the other side. Well, I think it is a very common thing in discussion to think that if you bring two arguments instead of one, you have a stronger argument. Actually, if the argument isn't good, 100 of them aren't as good as one good argument. But the critics just pile up these alleged contradictions and pile up these alleged parallels and so on. And there are just so many, many which they give, most of which, if you examine them closely, you find are like this. There are some which are difficult to explain, but in most cases, a fairly simple explanation shows them not to be valid arguments. And in any history of things that we cannot examine directly, there are bound to be certain elements that we don't understand, certain elements that we can't be sure of. There was a book published about 1875, which told about Lincoln's first inaugural and told how Stephen Douglas sat behind him on the platform and held his hat while he spoke. And more recently, a scholar has devoted a great part of 25 years of study to trying to prove whether Douglas held Lincoln's hat on that occasion or not. And he's written a long discussion to prove that there is no evidence that Douglas held Lincoln's hat. You will still find books that will tell you about the inaugural and how Douglas held Lincoln's hat. You will have others which say it has been disproven that he held his hat. Well, the way he disproved it was to show that the story was written by somebody who he has pretty good evidence wasn't there. So I think that removes it as an evidence that he did, but it doesn't prove he didn't. He still made it. In any history like that, there are many, many things that we just can't be sure about. And we will find things that appear to be contradictions to us, but if we knew the whole facts, there wouldn't be a contradiction. Now, if there were a great many of those, we'd have a tremendous problem. There aren't. There are comparatively few. But there are a great many alleged contradictions like this. Yes, Mr. Lee, further?
Nobody has done that.
There was a professor in Yale, professor of ancient Babylonian studies, who wrote an article in the Israel Exploration Quarterly about 6 or 7 years ago, in which he mentioned the fact that this source division, which has been done so much in connection with the Bible, has not been attempted at all in all the great mass of Babylonian material that are being studied, except just in one case of a few laws by one German legal scholar. It's the only case where this sort of thing has been attempted with the Babylonian material yet. And I don't think it will, because it's not the style now, but it was the style a century ago and was applied to the Bible as to many other things. Now, one other alleged contradiction in the flood story that you will often see referred to is the statement that the J and the P story have a different length of the flood. In the material I give to P, it tells you what day it was on which the flood began, and something over a year later, the flood ended. Now, they give this statement to P, and then in J, they put two statements about 40 days. It rained for 40 days, and the waters were on the earth for 40 days. And so they say, according to the J story, the whole thing was only about 80 days, but according to the P story, it lasted over a year. And here again, as you hear this given, it sounds like a tremendous argument, but it is an argument that is formed by taking two different statements and putting them separate. Like if I were to say, I spend a year and a half on a trip to Europe. I spent 10 days crossing the ocean. I spent 4 weeks in England. Later on, I had a wonderful month in Greece. Suppose I were to say that statement. And then suppose I were to also make the statement that I spent a year and a half on the trip. Well, somebody just takes part of the statement and says, 10 days crossing the ocean, 4 weeks in England, 4 weeks in Greece. There you've got a little over 2 months. But the other statement said a year and a half, so you have a contradiction. You don't at all. You have a discussion of a part. And as the flood story stands, it describes certain aspects of it which lasted for a long time, like 40 days of rain and 40 days of the waters spreading out over the earth. And incidentally, 40 days is a term which is often used in the scripture for a general term. If you tell me that there were 97 people present at a meeting, I will figure that if you are a man of truth and a man who's careful about your statement, that the number there was not 96 or 98, certainly not 105. If you say there were 97, I think you believe there were 97. But if you tell me there were 100 people present, I would think of 100 as a round number. And if there were 93 there, I wouldn't think you lied at all in saying there were 100. And if there were 108, I wouldn't think you lied in saying there were 100. We use general round figures for an approximation. And I might say that New York is 100 miles from here. Well, you figure distance from here to the City Hall in New York, it might be a little more or a little less. Somebody else figures to the border exactly how much it is. There are different ways of figuring it. I'm using a round figure if I use 100. If I said 97, you would figure that I was referring to something specific. Now, when it says the flood lasted from this day this year to this day this year, he is giving a precise figure. But when he says the waters were, it rained 40 days, whether it was 36 or whether it was 45, isn't necessarily involved in the statement. And so to take two statements of round numbers like that, and make them into contradiction to another statement of the totality of it, is, it's again, could be called an argument from silence. It is assuming that when you separate the documents, then each of them is complete, and since this only mentions certain figures, that's all the time there was involved in it. We haven't yet dealt with the question of style. That is our fourth argument, which we'll go on to later, but since we're speaking a fair amount about the flood at this time, it might be mentioned that in connection with this, the attempt is made to say that the style we find in Genesis 1, the enumerative style, is characteristic of the P story throughout. The style of 2 and 3, the more narrative style, is characteristic of the J story. And to take the words you find in the sections they give to J and say these are J words. And I mentioned to you how it says in Genesis 1, male and female created he them. In Genesis 2, it says the man and his wife. So they say male and female is a P phrase, and man and his wife is a J phrase. I think man and wife may be translated male and female sometimes in our English, because it is quite equivalent in the usage in the Hebrew. But when you get into the flood story, you'll find certain sections that they consider to belong to one of these documents, which includes in it the phrase appropriate to the other. And in those cases, they say those two or three words were inserted by the redactor at this point. There are numerous cases of where they do that. That is to say, when you separate the way they do, these styles do not work out consistently. I think that's an important thing to have in mind in connection with this flood story. It sounds like a marvelous illustration of a parallel which was evidently two original documents. And the flood story has thus destroyed many people's faith in the dependability of the book of Genesis as truth. But when you examine the arguments one by one, you find that they actually do not stand up. And many of the elements of the flood story, as we stated, are only mentioned once. Now, I want to read you from William Henry Green's book on the higher criticism of the Pentateuch, an illustration which someone made a good many years ago, which I think is very interesting in this connection. He took the story of the prodigal son in the New Testament. And he took this story and also the story of the Good Samaritan. And he divided each story into two documents, simply taking the repetition and putting them in each one. And then alleging that where these were, where something wasn't told, that it was a contradiction. And I thought I'd get to that today, but that would take a little more time than we have and would make you late for your next class. So I think we'll adjourn right now until next Tuesday.